there was movement around Australia. So gathered from far and near to listen to old mate Liam on the radio, loud and clear.
Is technocrat. And we've been talking about how technocrats are in charge now in Rome and Athens. And here's one other reason why you need to know about what exactly this means. Here's a headline that we saw today. Letting technocrats run Europe is bad politics and bad economics. Okay, whoa, so just what is a technocrat that this guy's railing against? Well, here is the definition. It is someone who is selected through bureaucratic processes, and that's the key, on the basis of specialized knowledge and performance, rather than a democratic or popular election. In a technocracy, decision makers would be selected based upon how knowledgeable and skillful they are in their field. So, let's talk about technocrats and who these guys are in Europe right now. So in Italy, you have this guy, Mario Monti. He's the new prime minister. He replaces Berlusconi. Now, he's not a politician like Berlusconi. He's an economist and former commissioner of the European Union. He's also the current European chairman of the Trilateral Commission. And in Greece, who has replaced Prime Minister Papandreou as the head of the unity government? It's a technocrat, Lucas Papademos, this guy here. He is former central banker. He was a vice president of the European Central Bank and former governor of the Bank of Greece. So these guys weren't elected by the citizens of the countries to serve in parliament, and that's the key. As to whether countries are better off being ruled by unelected bureaucrats, which are technocrats.
So put the billy on, Australia. Gather around that radio and come join the resistance. It's a Fair Dinkum radio show. Well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome from wherever you are listening all around the world. It is a Fair Dinkum radio show. We are broadcasting from the land down under in Australia. Leon with you again as we continue to look at the unfolding economic events taking place worldwide. Talking in the context of technocracy, we have mentioned many times on this program the developing technocracy worldwide. Indeed, Martin Schulz was quoted as saying, the president for the European Parliament, speaking to a German newspaper, said that he hoped that the Greek vote would be a yes. And the headline was, Martin Schulz wants technocrats government for Europe. Well, joining us is Patrick Wood. He is the host of the augustforecast.com, and he is also another website, technocracyrising.com. He has an excellent book, Technocracy Rising, The Dark Horse of the New World Order. It's not communism, socialism, or fascism. It is technocracy. Patrick, welcome and thank you for joining us.
I'm glad that you took the time to allow me to come on because this is such important stuff to talk about, Leon. You know, I know you know that, and I just always look forward to somebody who can really discuss it, who gets it.
Excellent. So. No, it's great. And, you know, it is such an important event. And as we speak to our people every week, we talk about the reality of events we are seeing in connection with the biblical worldview, the reality of events compared with prophetic utterances of what the future is going to look like. And you've written about this in your book, Technocracy, and we want to speak about how we see this technocracy developing. But let's start with Greece, and it is the hottest subject on the economic commentary board all around the world. And no matter which commentary I listen to from whatever worldview, there is no good prospects being spoken about with this current Greek situation. So let's begin with just a little bit of a summary of your thoughts on that comment, Patrick.
Well, Greece is, at this point, any way you look at it, any way you cut it, short-term, medium-term, long-term, the country is virtually destroyed, and it's helpless to make a comeback under its current situations. It's been a long time coming. Back in 2011, the country almost melted down then. They were able to kick the can down the road a little bit, but nothing was healed, nothing was fixed, and it came back today. It's worse now than it was then, and the situation is worse now than then. And, you know, people don't understand the huge human tragedy that's going on within Greece. And yes, you can blame the Greeks for their socialist mentality and their wanting everything for free and the government to do everything. You can do that. But listen, when the homeless rate goes from like, you know, whatever, on a whatever a base of 100% would be, it's up like 80% in the last year. People are sleeping on the street. Mm. People are they're scrounging for food to eat. They don't have jobs. They can't keep jobs. There's like 60% unemployment with young people right now. Banks are closed with no prospect at this point immediately of reopening. Mm. I mean, this is something that even exceeds the depths of the Great Depression in the 1930s. Mm. Mm. And everybody's just saying, ho-hum, the Greeks just need to get over it.
Mm. It's a tragedy. And you know, I think of the words of Yeshua Messiah when he said that one of the signs he spoke about was that men's hearts would be failing them for fear for the things that are coming on the earth. And that's where the Greek people are today. And I'm talking about just the common everyday people, as you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, these are the people that suffer the end of socialist planning, technocratic planning, of planning of other people. I mean, we the people, the common people, are the ones that generally suffer as a result of bad decisions of the past or you know, being funneled in a certain direction. But let's talk a little bit about that. You touched about the socialist spending in Greece with the socialist programs, a lot of people on welfare and dependent on government jobs. The percentages are probably the highest as one nation in the whole world in that regard. But is the debt, to your knowledge, is the debt that the current Greek people have totally because of socialist spending, or is a lot of their debt a lot of their debt actually come from a lot of the bailout from the bankers that took place in previous financial crises, like in 2008? In other words, did the people incur debt accredited to them, which really went to the banks as a result of bankers' gambling issues?
Well, some of it is certainly true. But if you look at it on a long-term basis, let's go back 20 years, 25 years, when these policies first kind of got set where they were going to have this socialist mentality, the crazy work week hours they have and so on. And you could point to the Greek government as bringing these policies before the people to vote on, and they accepted them, and they enjoyed the benefits of having all those freebies all throughout the years. Of course, they didn't do it spending out of their assets at all. They did it based on borrowed money. Now, listen, the people in Greece are culpable for everything they took that really didn't belong to them, in a sense. But the people who allowed it to happen in the first place, the people who lent money to the government, had their eyes wide open.
Yes.
As to what they were doing.
Yes.
They're the ones that are really truly culpable. And you can blame the people on the street to some extent, but it's like, you know, if you compare them to drug addicts, you could blame a drug addict for being a drug addict, yeah. I guess. You know, hey, you shouldn't put that stuff in your veins. Don't do that. It'll kill you. Mm. But listen, the guy, the drug dealer that gives him the heroin or whatever it is he's doing, that person is the real criminal here. If he didn't exist, the guy on the street never would have been a drug addict in the first place.
Mm. Exactly. And it's really those that, I guess, control the narrative that are the greatest – have the greatest responsibility here. I mean, let's talk about this vote because, you know, the current government was elected on basically not paying back the money, right? That's what they basically, yeah. You know, come in on this election campaign. They said, we don't want the EU to control us. We aren't going to pay the money. Vote for us. So the people did. Then they get in and all of a sudden Tsipras realises this is a big problem. The banks close. All of a sudden everything shuts down. Then he goes back to the people again. Now, you could read this a few ways. How do you read what he did when he went back to the people and said, okay, I want your mandate again before I go back to the negotiating table? How do you read the play there?
It did no good. The people just got shafted, and they know it. That's why they're rioting in the streets right now and throwing firebombs over there. They're saying they have been betrayed, and yes, they were again betrayed where a popular vote was completely ignored by the prime minister. When they got to the negotiating table with that, I wasn't there. There was no video record of it that I can find, but I would almost envisioned that the people at the negotiating table laughed at the at the referendum vote. Said, "Hey, okay, that was a good laugh. Now let's get down to business."
Exactly. And I mean, isn't this though the conditions that we see in Greece today? Speaking about the broader picture of the technocratic aims, isn't the condition in Greece today perfect for the technocratic meme? I mean, isn't this exactly where they want a country so they can say, well, it's obvious that you can't run it, these elected people can't run it, and you know, therefore you need to put these people in place because they will look after our assets, our money that we're giving you to survive, right?
Yes, I think that that would be a fair statement, and that would have to be a statement at first glance on a theory. It would seem like that would be the right theory to propose, looking at the current events. But let me convert that from theory to fact for you. Okay, this is key. Listeners should pay attention here.
That's what we want.
There was an article just today in the website called ZeroHedge.com. That's ZeroHedge.com. It's an economic blog. They have a lot of stimulating articles. Let's put it that way on there. It's a very serious website, however. They have an article that's titled The Shocking 2008 AIG Report on, quote, Empire Europe and the Death of Greece. Now, this article is written from one perspective that does not understand technocracy. I don't hold that against them, but they have uncovered some original knowledge on what was playing out in Greece. They put it in this article, and it demonstrates exactly what you just said. And there was an economist working for the French office of AIG in 2007, and he wrote some predictions, a forecast of where he saw things going, and it was an amazing forecast, because it could have been written yesterday. And let me see if I could just find the exact text here to read. I don't want to read the whole article. That would be ridiculous. But let me see if I can find the exact place here where it talks about Greece and what he said was the goal of crushing Greece. Mm-hmm. And let's see here. I got to go down a little bit further. Bear with me for a minute. I should have underlined this before I started. I wasn't thinking about it. You brought it up, and I thought, oh yeah, I got to talk about this.
That's right.
Here. Here we go.
Okay.
Here it is. This was Connolly's answer, the economist's answer. He says, to use global issues as excuses to extend power. Then there's a list of bullet points. Number one, environmental issues. Increase control over member countries, advance the idea of global governance. Number two, terrorism. Use excuse for greater control over police and judicial issues, increase extent of surveillance. Number three, global financial crises. Kill two birds with one stone. Now, two birds that he lists here as the free market, the Anglo-Saxon economies, yep, with one stone.
Yep.
The one stone is Europe-wide regulator attempts at global financial governance. Exactly. And the last point, number four, is relative to the EMU itself. Create a crisis to force introduction of the European Economic Government. This is exactly what's playing out. And then the author of this article goes on to say, and here it is, in four simple bullet points laid out in a seven-year-old presentation, a prediction which is about to be proven right. Mm. Because once Greece folds, next will be Italy, Spain, Portugal, and so on, until the European Economic Community also known as a European empire, controlled by a handful of northern European players and the bankers financially backing them, shifts from mere vision to reality. Now, having said that, this is a seven-year-old presentation by a guy who was on the inside of the European Union for a couple of decades. He's a chief economist, one of the chief economists at AIG. Actually, he was a global strategist back then. This was his assessment based on his inside knowledge of what was going on. The European empire is the heartbeat, if you will, of technocracy. This is where it's unfolding first. Mm-hmm. We're about to be flipped. Mm-hmm. I say flipped. We're about to be judo flipped from capitalism into technocracy, and it's being conducted around the pivot point of Greece right now. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. And that's why this issue is so important to watch, the way it's played out and the different moves that are made. Can you give us a reference for that article you're just reading from?
Yes, I can. Again, the title of the article is "The Shocking 2008 EIG." The Shocking 2008 AIG Report on, quote, Empire Europe, close quote, and the death of Greece.
And is that on Zero Hedge, is it?
This is on ZeroHedge.com.
Yep. Yep.
That's correct.
Thank you. Well, exactly. I mean, in that article, that proves that, I mean, we know it goes back a lot further, back to the 1920s. But 7 years ago, that article basically outlining the four steps to bringing about this European governance, and bankrupting the countries, and showing that democratically elected governments are incapable of actually looking after the finances, is a very important part of that, because then they can arguably say to the people, look, this hasn't worked, what you're doing. You're on the streets. You're homeless. The banks are shut. You need us to manage things for you, right?
I think it's a little bit deeper than that. That's true.
Yeah, go ahead.
But I think the deeper policy right now is to kill capitalism altogether. Yeah. Worldwide, not just in Greece, but worldwide. Let me give you evidence of that. Again, this is hard evidence. A statement by Christiana Figueres. Hang on a second here. Hopefully, you won't get hung up here. Christiana Figueres on February 3rd of this year. She's the climate change czar at the United Nations, numero uno. She's the big one. She says in a press release in Europe, this is the first time in the history of mankind that we are setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution. And just before that, she said, just to reiterate, this is probably the most difficult task we have ever given ourselves, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. Close quote. This is blatant. This is Mein Kampf sort of stuff, you know? Laying it out, capitalism is on the guillotine right now.
And I think this
is what's playing out in Greece right now. If this is their policy to discredit capitalism and get people to where they'll beg for anything to restore order, the technocrats will move in with their alternative economic system, which the UN calls green economy, but which we call technocracy. They're one and the same. And they will say, we have a solution for you. What do you think? And the Greek people are going to snap at anything that's put in front of them just to stop the chaos in the streets. And Greece is not the end of it. Greece is just the beginning. That's what this guy is saying here in this article. Greece is the beginning, not the ending. Right behind it should next be coming France, Spain, Italy, perhaps France. And it's going to the risk is now it will implode the entire capitalistic economic system in the world. This is not good.
Look, it's very important. And, I hear As I listen to different commentary about it all around the world, it is an impossible debt situation. I mean, even the US dollar, and look at the debt you folk have. I mean, every country is being bought into this this place one way or another, whether it's by, you know, socialist planning or whatever it is. Now, let's go back to exactly what happened then with this meeting this week and what the EU are actually demanding. Let's talk about what they are saying they will do for Greece if Greece basically cooperates, right?
Well, it's basically, on one hand, it's basically the same old stuff they've been saying all along, that the Greeks must exercise more austerity. That's number one. They must cut back on their spending even further, which is just beating a dead horse at this point. They don't have any spending going on in the country. The banks are shut. People aren't getting their pensions. The pharmacies are run out of drugs. I mean, it's a mess. The whole country's in collapse right now. So demanding more austerity is just the stupidest thing you could possibly say to a people in this condition. But aside from austerity, the big goal here is to force Greece into privatizing its major assets that it's been holding on to for a long time, its public utilities, for instance, its public monuments, its public property, its public industries that it still owns because of nationalization years ago. They want Greece, and they're forcing Greece, to privatize those assets, take them away from the government, and put them into private hands. And I don't need to speak too long about guess who the private hands are going to be that these assets get sold into. Yeah. And I would say to you, don't bother submitting a bid, okay, because you're not going to win.
Yeah.
It's going to be the people who are connected to the trilateral cronies who are going to pick up all these assets and claim them for their own. Mm. Mm-hmm. So this seems to be the big goal at this point. And even within that, if they can't force them all together to get rid of everything, they want them to create public-private partnerships where they will get special concessions to run those industries for the government and for the sake of the people. But the people in the end will get absolutely just totally manipulated by price increases and stuff like that. It'll be ugly if looking at the rest of the world is any judge.
Well, you know, those four points that you just mentioned that Connolly spoke about, what the point is here, this global financial crisis, kill two birds, the free market Anglo-Saxon economics, with one stone, Europe-wide regulator attempts at global financial control. Now, Greece is so important because the fallout from Greece means Anglo-Saxon economies obviously will follow, because this has to be an opening wedge to bring about technocratic control of governance. And there already is technocrats, Pat, and you would be familiar with their names. I won't mention them, I'll let you speak about it, but how technocrats have already been installed in Italy, in other countries in Europe, which are people they've put in there to try and rectify the finances. Well, that's the propaganda. But nevertheless, the precedent has already been done in other countries, hasn't it, before Greece?
Well, both Greece and Italy, as your introduction pointed out, were given appointed prime ministers, Papademos in Greek and Mario Monti in Italy, and they came in at a time when both countries were in serious condition of default and almost bankruptcy and collapse. And I would suggest that, the propaganda aside, the reason, and by the way, they were both sent in by the European press, called them technocrats on the way in, and they both happened to be members of the Trilateral Commission. But they came in my view, they came in as receivers in a bankruptcy case rather than as anybody interested in helping the people of the country.
Yeah.
They were there to rearrange the assets of the nation to protect the creditors that were owed money by that nation. You see, this was no benevolent thing that the EU was doing to these two countries. they sent these receivers in, and nobody ever really looked at their actions with that point of view, except maybe me and a few others. What were they doing at that time with the assets? How were they rearranging the assets of the country to protect the creditors? And I would suggest at this point that as we're looking at the current events in Greece today, which is a mere 4 years away from when Papademos was there, that we're seeing the fallout of that right now. Of his actions back then, yeah. We're seeing some of the fallout of that right now as virtually the whole country is being demanded to be privatized.
Yeah, exactly.
They're going to take over the assets of the country. The people are going to be left holding a bag. They're the ones that are going to get their bank accounts taken away. They call it a bail-in. The bankers are going to get their cash, and the other private creditors, if you will, are going to get all the primo assets of the country to call their own, and the people are just basically going to be living on a big rock at the mercy of whoever comes by and wants to throw a silver coin into their bucket.
That's it. And that's the agenda, that the banks will get their cash because they'll have this bail-in situation happening. But the actual government-owned assets, that will also be taken by creditors and leased back to the people. I mean, you know, in the end, the people will own nothing. I mean, let's look at it at the moment. Cyprus has until Wednesday to get all of these laws passed by the current parliament that he's got together there. Now, the people are rioting saying, no, we voted for you not to do this. Now you're going to do it, right? If Cyprus can't get this through the parliament, right, for instance, what's the next step? I mean, obviously the banks are insolvent. There's no money there. That means they stay shut. The people can't get their 60 euro a day to actually survive. If the Greek parliament does not pass what the bankers here are demanding, doesn't this set the stage for riots, a national emergency?
It's happening right now. It's not that it will set the stage. It has set the stage, and it's happening right this very second. Watch the newscast. Go on the internet. Watch the newscast, a live newscast from Europe right now. People are rioting in the street right now with firebombs and the whole nine yards that we saw back in 2011. It's happening all over again right this second.
Well, Michael Snyder, writing on his blog, he has sort of taken in his commentary a bit of the angle that the Germans have set up this deal so that really Greece cannot fulfill it. I mean, it's just sort of like the conditions are so erroneous that it is impossible for the Greeks to actually fulfill what they're asking anyway, because Germany wants Greece out. But I'm not sure about this. I can see that they could bring about a situation for a purposeful, a planned default. But isn't the overall picture, Patrick, that the collective must stay together? I mean, taking one out, wouldn't that only be a temporary move to institute the further measures we're talking about?
Well, look, Germany's talking out of both sides of its mouth on this. On one hand, they say they want, they want Greece to go out of the EU. On the other hand, they say they're desperate for them to stay. If what this article says in Zero Hedge is true, and at this point I tend to believe that this guy was, had a good insight back 7 years ago, then the real goal is to force Greece into a collapse situation so that there will be a domino effect started within the European Union.
Yes.
To the point where it will take the European Union down to its knees so that the Empire of Europe or the European Empire can finally be formed the way they wanted it to be formed in the first place, mm-hmm. which is as a form of technocracy, not as a capitalistic system.
Yep.
Now, if they're on board with this, if Germany's on board with this and part of it, I have no reason to think they're not, then
it's part of the
their
game.
That's right. Their whole exercise in this is, like you said, to give Greece conditions it cannot possibly fulfill. They're setting them up to fail. They will fail. And when they fail, other countries are going to follow suit because they're just going to say, hey, if Greece can get away with it, we're going to get away with it too. That, in fact, that was a knee-jerk reaction when Greece finally said, we're not going to pay our debts 2 weeks ago. Puerto Rico immediately stood up and said that very same weekend, guess what? We can't pay our debts either, and we're not going to. Huh. So, and we, of course, we own Puerto Rico by and large as a territory of the United States, but they have $78 billion outstanding to Western banks.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Don't think that's not going to sting.
Yeah. I was amused by that they come out straight away and said, well, if Greece isn't paying their debts, we're not going to either. And, of course, this is the domino that we're talking about. This is a domino that other countries will be looking at too. For instance, if the bank has just said to Greece, well, we're going to wipe off, 50% of your debt to give you a chance, well, then every other country would know, well, this is what we can do. But that's not going. That obviously isn't going to happen. But let's say that even if it did miraculously get through the Greek parliament, isn't there other European parliaments that actually have to back it as well? Like, apparently German and Finland especially, they're two nations, they're really critical of what Greece is doing. Obviously, you've just spoke about Germany speaking out of both hands, but don't other countries in that bloc have to actually agree to what's being proposed?
I don't think so. I think they will squawk and they will moan, but they'll go along with whatever the EU group says to do. They're the people in charge. They're the people that do the negotiating. They don't have to go back to voters and get any kind of referendum. you heard about Greece voting, and of course Greece voted and it was totally ignored. But you don't hear about anybody in the Euro bloc putting anything to a vote. They have nothing to vote on. They're not given anything to vote on. It's like, you will do what we tell you to do, and that's it. That's one reason a lot of people, individuals, are very frustrated in the EU right now, because they figure whatever's happening to Greece could just as easily happen to them. If these people turn their eyeballs on them, they could be in just as much trouble as Greece. They're very nervous over there.
Exactly. Well, as we see, Tsipras had to get rid of his previous finance minister because he was basically saying, look, this is an economic hit here. They're going to take us out, and no one could negotiate with him. So because he's in the way, they just got rid of him, right? This is what happens. Anyone who doesn't go along with the agenda, they're just muscled out straight away.
That's what's happening. It's happened all the way along the line, and it's going to keep happening because Greece has no offer on the table whatsoever that can make it succeed. And I would say, too, if they were to give Greece a 50% debt holiday, if you will, and if it was successful, temporarily at least, to kick the can down the road, say 5 or 10 years, let's say other countries, let's say Spain and Portugal came along and they got debt relief on the same magnitude, the effect of that would be to save the European Union as it exists today. That's what would happen. Now, you have to raise the question. According to this article in Zero Hedge today, and I'm just questioning this, really. I haven't really dug into it much deeper, but my intuition tells me I'm right here. If what this article in Zero Hedge says is true, then they are not betting at all on the success of Greece. They're betting on its failure.
Yes.
So it will take down the rest of the EU, including the big go-along countries that have been difficult to muscle around. By the time they're done with Greece, Spain, and the rest of them, Italy, the rest of these countries are going to be begging for the European economic government, if you will,
well,
to come in.
As it said in this article, this European economic government, I mean, at the moment, that European economic government doesn't really exist, does it? I mean,
not at all.
There's all those factions. But what they want to do is obviously implement this one European bloc, which was the original experiment of the euro, isn't it? To do that.
Yes, that was the original intent, and it didn't quite ever come out that way. But you see members of the Trilateral Commission operating in the EU from the very, very beginning. Even David Rockefeller said so in his memoirs book, I think it was 1998. He gave credit to the European Commission being created by early members of the Trilateral Commission going back to the 1970s. And they have been instrumental in its operation ever since. And the fact of that, the proof of that is, I mean, it's just so thin. The proof of it is that when Greece and Italy were on the rocks, two members of the Trilateral Commission were sent in, called technocrats on the way in, and went in and did stuff that nobody really ever documented or you know, held them accountable for. Okay, are there no other people in the European Union besides members of the Trilateral Commission who can do anything constructive to help, you know, to help those people out? I don't think so. I think it merely demonstrates who has the real power in the EU, and it's not the EU itself. It's not just the member parliamentary people that come from various countries. The people that are calling the shots there that want to convert this into the European economic government, if you will, or the empire, the European empire, these are members of the Trilateral Commission who have been working since at least 1973 to bring in their new international economic order, which we now know as technocracy. In other words, there's a smaller group within the larger group that have their own agenda, and it's really different than just the European Union as it stands today.
And I mean, look at one of these other points that Connolly was speaking about with terrorism, and look at Operation Terror taking place worldwide. I mean, what's with the unrest that's unfolding in Greece now? They don't need terrorism, because that in itself creates the same environment to bring about, more of a police state, more of judicial, oversight over judicial controls. That's and right. As he said, the increase of the extent of surveillance. And this is a very important plank in the building of a true technocracy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. You have to have that that fear, that angst build up inside of people where you can trick them and fool them into believing things that they never would otherwise have believed in the first place. And this is what this whole terrorism thing is all about. I have to, I haven't really done a great amount of thinking or research on this yet, but quite a bit, actually. But I'm thinking about ISIS. I'm thinking about Al-Qaeda. I'm thinking about all of the, the various terror events that have happened around the world. And I'm not suggesting that the people in the Trilateral Commission are calling the shots on individual terror attacks. But let me tell you, these people are backing the terrorist movements in general, encouraging them to keep on, doing what they're doing to spread fear and just chaos into societies that had none. That's exactly what happened in Egypt. It's exactly what happened in Libya. It's exactly what's happening in Syria right now. And it's going to happen in other countries. It's going to happen in Iran pretty soon. It's happened in Iraq. And, the world is going upside down because of these terrorist influences. And all the while we're looking at terrorism, and oh my gosh, we say they're coming at our southern border now too. Other things are happening behind the scenes, like in Greece, to turn the capitalistic world upside down so these people can assume control.
Well, really, the new order that's being built can only be understood in a multi-pronged outlook. I mean, you have to be able to see that Operation Terror is connected with the economic new order, and it's connected with the new political order. It's all of these things are important tools in the arsenal of the of the planners to bring about this state of fear where government is needed to actually keep us safe, and we need government to pay our food. We need government for all of these different things. I mean, let's think about this surveillance for a moment. You documented a few weeks ago the case in Oregon and how they are bringing about this pay per mile volunteer program called Oregon, I think it's called. And I was looking at the government website there this morning, and they were saying, this is not a test case, this is the beginning, right? so you've got cash-strapped state governments that are now looking for every means available to increase their tax base. But it's not just that, Patrick. It's not just economy, because that ties in with surveillance and the whole smart grid concept of what technocracy needs. So technocracy needs both the surveillance and the cash and the monitoring to actually bring about its smart grid that it's developed.
It's part of the infrastructure they're building.
Yes, it's the infrastructure.
That's all it is, infrastructure. It's the basic building blocks of technocracy is being built with our own money, I might add, with taxpayer money. And they're building it so they can take it over. and literally put a manacle around all of our necks and force us to do what they want to do. And since you brought up the article that appeared on WorldNet Daily, the name of it was Feds Want to Track Your Every Move on Road. The writer of the story interviewed me quite extensively on this. I helped him with some of the research and stuff. He did a great job of putting the story out. But one of the things this article does is it proves, and this report we dug up that came from the University of Iowa, actually, that really caught our attention. This report said bluntly that the tax that will be levied for the miles you drive will be based on your carbon footprint. And you have to understand what carbon footprint means in order to understand the nefarious nature of this. You can track GPS miles all you want, but when those mileages get racked up into a computer somewhere by, you know, cell phone or whatever it is, and is sitting there waiting for a charge to be applied to it, they're going to go into other databases to determine what your personal carbon footprint is, based on your spending, based on the size of your home, based on the type of appliances you have that they know about through Smart Grid, based on your lifestyle, how you travel, how many planes you take, what kind of cars you have, and they will custom tailor your carbon footprint in order to figure out how much you're going to pay. And if you've been a bad boy, and you've been watering your grass three times a week or whatever, and you know, you've got a big gas-guzzling car or whatever that gets 12 miles a gallon, well, you're going to pay through the nose. But if you drive a little hybrid or a Prius or some little electric car and, you know, you take the bus and you ride your bicycle to work and you take the light rail and you do all these goody-two-shoes things, you know, you live in a downtown stack-em-and-pack-em type of a place, you're going to get away probably getting a tax credit. They'll probably send you money for being a good boy.
Yeah.
It's going to end up being a means of punishment rather than just a tax collection.
Yeah.
And this is proof that these various databases, Leon, are meant to collude with each other. I've said that, you know, we've talked before. I've said this many times. Smart Grid database, Obamacare database, Common Core Education Standards database, your purchasing databases, all your emails, all your phone calls and stuff that they're recording up here and all around the world.
Everything.
I have said for a long time that the original intent of these databases was to talk to each other and build a profile on each individual that can be used for stuff like this. And now we have proof, not just a smoking gun. We have dead to rights proof that this is what they intend to do.
Yes.
The question is now, is anybody going to stand up and give a rip that we found this out?
Well, it's everything. It's everything to be integrated. I mean, off the Oregon Department of Transport website, they say that those who volunteer to participate, the Road Usage Charge Program, also known as Origo, will assess a charge of 1.5% cents per mile. Well, just that's the selling. That's a starting point, right? They'll be able to change at any time, and issue a gas tax credit as warranted. This will not be another pilot program, but rather the start of an alternative method of generating fuel tax from specific vehicles. So what they're saying is this is here to stay, right? But what you said there is so important that everything is integrated. One of our listeners wrote to me and said that his neighbour in a particular place did not register their dog. They moved to another area. They didn't re-register their dog, and she received a notice saying her licence had been cancelled. Now, there's the integration of councils with Department of Roads. In other words, there's two databases talking to each other, and what they've worked out is how to punish people for non-compliance in one area is to withdraw a driver's license or vehicle registration. And that way they use force to basically, you know, bring you back into that accreditation system. But you're right. Every aspect, travel, dog registration, everything you do must be documented, because in the end, the Agenda 21 carbon footprint monitoring is what has to take place, isn't it?
That's right, 100%. And again, it all ties back to energy, to monitor, you know, gasoline that makes cars go, it's energy. That's key. It's just as important as the electricity and gas that you have coming to your home or business.
Now, let's jump into the environment, because we're on that. Now, number one point that Connolly spoke about with this whole global issue was environmental issues, increased control over member countries, an advanced idea of global governance. Now, this is in the context of environmental issues. Now, you wrote, Pope Francis speaks technocracy. Now, here's the Pope, the head of the largest Christian group on the earth. Here he is slated to speak at the two houses of Congress in September, then on to the UN. Now, this is very significant. I've been talking about it, how here the Pope is using the Christian edge, if you like, context with the parishioners under him and world leaders worldwide, to amalgamate and bring together so many different factions under the guise of religion. And here he's speaking technocracy, and he's going to the UN to advocate that climate change is the greatest moral agenda of our time.
That's right. And here's the ironic thing about the Pope's encyclical that he just issued on climate change, is that he actually used the word technocracy several times, and he talked about the technocratic paradigm. And it's interesting that he becomes the instrument of misinformation on this whole topic that we're talking about today, because he uses the word in terms of the existing world order. In other words, he looks at unbridled capitalism as technocracy, and that's not technocracy. Whoever wrote this paper had an ulterior motive to kill two birds with one stone.
Exactly.
One was to tell people to run into the arms of the United Nations and sustainable development and global governance, and the other is to stay away from evil technocrat systems, evil technocracy people and crony capitalism, et cetera, today, and put those behind you and move towards technocracy with a capital T. I've never seen such a display of misinformation and disinformation in my entire life, and that includes Russia during, or the USSR during the Cold War, and they were masters at it. But they would call black white and white black and make you confused to think you even knew what either one of those meant. But here the Pope is doing it on a global scale, yet, on the other hand, he is talking about technocracy, even if it's in a diametrically opposite point of view. And that alone gives me interest, just makes it interesting. Who taught him this word? Who taught him to talk about technocracy? Who put these ideas into his head? The Pope did not actually pen, believe me. The Pope did not pen. It's encyclical. Yeah. And it's interesting, his chief science advisor, can't remember the guy's name right, it's in my article, I can't remember his name, it's a German name. This guy is an atheist, go figure. He's a pantheist, meaning he believes God is in everything, and he believes in Mother Earth and Gaia, and that the Earth is a living, living, breathing being with self-awareness. This is the guy that's advising the Pope on science and climate change, an atheist.
This is Hans Schulnuber. He's a true believer in pantheism and really, the green agenda, the worship of Gaia.
I'll tell you what, the Catholics around the world better stand up and take stock of what's going on in Rome right now, because they never bargained to have an atheist be a close advisor to the Pope like this. I mean, I disagree with the Catholic Church on a thousand different things, but that's immaterial.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard, Lord Monckton, in despair because, he's just totally shattered that the Pope's going this way because Lord Monckton's a Catholic, right? And he's committed to, staying true to this order no matter what. I say, well, look, get out of it. I mean, if this system is going against what your conscience knows to be true, why are you there, right? But I mean, it is a collectivist religion, which is very similar to other collectivist bodies. The people believe they have to stay true to it, in order to find salvation. But I've often heard Christopher Monckton in despair talking about this, and it does bring me a little bit of amusement. But look, the people in there, there are many dedicated people, but they need to understand that the head of this system is very much involved in developing this new order, whether it's the new economic order, incorporating surveillance, the whole green religion. And I mean, you know, he talks about the poor and all that. And we all care about the poor, but they're not to be, they're only being used as reasons to bring about change, which takes away really the true wealth that God designed for individual humanity. But Patrick, you've been traveling around the country. Give us a little overview of some of the meetings and the people you've been talking to, and the feedback you're getting from your book, from people that are coming to an understanding of technocracy being a very important part of what we're facing in the future.
Some people are really getting it, Leon, which is encouraging that at least a few are. But I run across some people that have read the book and still don't get it. They're still looking backwards to, you know, old socialistic or communistic models. They're still looking at the national political scene as being the only way to save the country or anybody. And they just, you know, they read the book, they don't get it. I know they see the words go in their head, but they don't stick, or at least they don't connect the dots. Maybe that's my fault for not writing the book in such a way that everybody gets it. But
it's not your fault.
It takes two or three readings.
No, look, it's conditioning. And you know, humanity, yep. Look, we are all damaged, Patrick, in some way. Yep.
That's right.
We live in this world where, you know, I speak about it a lot, where we're being conditioned by the, you know, the continual bombardment of the memes that, you know, we've been exposed to.
Yes.
But, I mean, I like the answer that you come to, that I've read, that you've written about often, is that the answer comes back to us as individuals. And
yes.
Let's close on this individual action, that each of us must take individual action. We can't just simply watch, tyranny come in and the world change around us. We have to be part of that change, either for the good or if we are complacent, we are watching the very freedoms and liberties that God intended for humanity to be taken off us. Let's close on this is really the answer, individuality under God, freedom of action to do what we can to help men and women think about what we see taking place right before us and what we can do.
That's right. Well, you know, for the most part, the truly evangelical church is waiting for the rapture of the church where Jesus Christ comes back and takes his church to heaven. And then begins that seven-year period that will result in judgment upon the earth. And that is a blessed hope, according to the Bible. We're told to comfort one another with these words and so on, and many people do. But that's not an excuse just to sit back and say, oh, well, you know, we're going to be out of here. You know, who cares about the world, whatever. Listen, we live in the world, even if we're not of the world. We live in the world, and the people that are suffering in the world today They need to see God's mercy, that's number one, but they need to see that other people care about them, and they need to see solutions. They don't have any solutions right now. And except that people would stand up and combat these people who are arguing against them and give them concrete solutions, they have no hope. Like the people in Greece right now, they have no hope. There's nothing there for them. They're desperate. They're throwing firebombs. That's the best they can do. Well, that's no life. So, you know, where are the Christians in this whole setting? I'm sure they're there to some extent. But, you know, by and large, over time, the Christian church at large has completely missed it. But on the other hand, I'll say it's interesting in my travels that a lot of the people I see that come forward and, you know, in places I talk and stuff and where my book is shared, the Tea Party meetings, you know, political meetings, stuff like that, the great majority of them, Leon, are Bible-believing Christians. This blows me away. Individual churches are taking no steps basically whatsoever to be, you know, socially active at all. But the movement itself is comprised primarily of Bible-believing Christians. I've scratched my head over this for some time, and the only thing I can think of is that these are the ones who still have a clear enough mind, that aren't wrapped up in one type of sin or another, perhaps, that can really see what's going on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I find the same, and I think the church is largely, you know, as bodies, are basically complying with what's being rolled out. I mean, we could talk about the marriage equality con and all that. See, many of the churches just capitulating completely this complete cultural, I call it one of the greatest psychological you know, experiments ever in the building of this new order is to change black into white. But there are people within those bodies, as you've mentioned, that are earnest and true. And I mean, that's most of my listeners are those people. And they say, look, we try and talk to our churches about these matters. They don't want to know about it. If we try and talk about it, they've basically forced us out. Some people, they've been actually moved out of their churches because they're speaking about these issues. But we will see these things. But I think what you've said there is a good thing to finish on. I mean, we should treat others as we would expect them to treat us.
That's right.
And we see a problem coming. We see the problem of sin culminating, but we do know the answer. The answer is faith in Yeshua the Messiah. The gospel is taught his people. There is salvation. There is redemption from this world. And that is the blessed hope that we wait for. Patrick, it's been really great speaking with you. Keep up the good work. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Leon. God bless you and keep up your good end down there.
Oh, hi. I'm so glad you're on time. I'm V. I'm looking forward to showing you around Plandopolis today. My husband works from home. He's a virtual engineer working on one of the city's desalination plants. He controls the robots who do all the important maintenance. I think he basically plays computer games for a living. You ready to go? Have you got your calorie card open on your smartphone? I registered your visit with Slick Travel Corp the other day, so they've allotted you a journey time to match mine. It makes so much sense, doesn't it? Switch off brain and go to work. With this many people around, I'm glad there's a mega computer in charge. We're so lucky. Our kids were allocated a school quite near my practice, so I can drop them off on the way. It saves on our calorie ration. Well, it won't be long until the little darlings get their career announcements. They've been working so hard, so I'm sure they'll get something good. Not that there's anything wrong with fixing carbon scrubbers for a living or anything. Are you hungry? Let's pop to the market as we're passing. Right, what's on the menu this month? No, not meat. It's not your birthday. The Global Food Council are doing a really good job of keeping food production going. I mean, you don't get the choice you used to, but we're better off than most. I think it's probably easiest to walk from here. You barely see a car in the city centre nowadays, unless you're rich. Well, the state knows they just aren't practical anymore. We're all trying to meet our global carbon deal. Electric bikes are so much better for getting around our neighbourhood. And why waste valuable space on car parks when you can use them to grow food? I don't care what you say, Alex. They don't deserve to live in that ghetto. They are completely disconnected. No high-speed transport system, no new internet. They miss out on jobs and many essential services, too. Oh, hi again. What a day. I had to make an emergency visit to the Cry Freedom ghettos. I mean, I miss my sister like mad, but I'm glad they went when they moved to New Amsterdam. They're safe from climate change on the floating city. That must be her now. It's much easier to meet up with friends virtually now. Well, so many cities have banned cars in central areas. Ooh, looks like she's got some juicy gossip.